Einsteigen, aufdrehen, losfahren. Mit dem neuen Volkswagen T-Roc bist du bereit für den großen Auftritt. Selbstbewusst und voller Power. Du steigst ein? Keine Kompromisse. Nur du und der Moment. Alles passt. Dein Sound, dein Drive, dein T-Roc. Rockt. Der neue T-Roc.
Stu does America.
Show's on YouTube. Did you know that? YouTube.com/StuDoesAmerica. Be sure to subscribe. Hit the bell for notifications. It's also on podcasts. Follow wherever you get your podcasts. By the way, happy June 24th. 6/24/22. It is the anniversary of the overturning of Roe versus Wade. We have great merch items celebrating that fact from just a few years ago. Was it 3 years ago now? 6/24/22 merch is all available at StuDoesMerch.com. Code is Stu10. What a great merch day for this program, as well as his Andrew Cuomo primary day today. AndrewCuomoIsAwful.com, still active as well. You can get both of those things 10% off with the code Stu10. Josh Hammer is going to join us with his reaction to the latest in Iran, as well as a preview of some of the Supreme Court decisions on the docket for this year. I mentioned today's special anniversary, 6/24/22. We'll look at the current state of abortion rights in America, but we're going to start by doing the truth behind the ceasefire, because, I mean, what a day. These days, man, there's so much going on. There's so many big topics to cover. Right now, of course, Israel and Iran in the middle of what might be a ceasefire. Who even knows? The question asked by the New York Times, can Iran, Israel, and the U.S. now all claim to have won? Now, I can see how the U.S. would claim they won. The bombings, they've been out, nothing else happened to them. I can see how Israel would say that they are winning, right? I can see how they say they've won. They've done lots of damage. Don't really see how Israel or Iran is going to say that coherently. But it's nice to see that the New York Times are aligning with Iranian state media that had this to say. Translate for you. Perhaps America has joined the war because we were very close to annihilating Israel. And it was in the closing stages. Who's up for that kind of analysis? Well, you can get that either from Iranian state media or just maybe the New York Times. A few things that happened over the past 24 hours, and actually maybe 36 at this point. Between 3:30 and 6 a.m. on June 22nd, U.S. carried out the airstrikes. Remember that. Late at night, June 23rd, Iran launched missile attacks on the United States. June 24th, in the wee hours of the morning, Iran accepted a ceasefire proposal. Early morning as well, June 24th, Donald Trump speaks directly with Netanyahu. June 24th, Donald Trump on social media announces a complete and total ceasefire and an official end to the 12-day war. Now, of course, the war has been going on for much longer than 12 days, but this particular battle, maybe 12 days. Of course, it was the end of that war after a few hours where they get to kill each other for a little while longer. There's a purge period. It's weird how we're working purges now into these agreements. It's a very strange tactic that we've kind of developed over time, and we're not the first to do it. Like, I can certainly understand, like, back in the 1700s, right, where you'd be like, hey, we're stopping firing and there's battles going on and you have to get somebody, a messenger, to tell the general, hey, we're not firing anymore. But today, with today's media, I feel like you should be able to alert everyone to stop firing missiles almost right away. Like, I think it should be like almost instant, but I don't know, an hour? Really, do you need a 12, 13 hour period? Brent Shore points it out. A note for all future ceasefires. I don't think it's a healthy practice to give both sides a final killing round. And it's kind of a good point when you think about it. I don't think good things necessarily come out of that, but that is what happened last night. It seems like for the moment, this thing is holding itself together. We'll see if that lasts. And obviously, we'll just follow it as closely as we can, both here and over on radio. You know, that's all we can do. That's all we can do. Because I will say, some of the stuff is really difficult to decipher what is actually happening. U.S. Democrats, of course, are doing their jobs. What are their jobs? Of course, they are introducing a resolution to check Trump's use of military against Iran. So they've got a resolution going. But that didn't go far enough for our friend Al Green, not the singer, the incredible congressman. Al Green introduces article of impeachment against Donald Trump. Yes, you're back in that time once again. Congratulations, everybody. It's impeachment time. It's worked so well for the Democrats in the past. They're going to give it another whirl. Here is the fan out of the resolution, which of course has not been numbered yet, but it is. I read through it. Basically, they're just saying he should have gone to Congress. And there is an actual argument about this. It's not just Donald Trump or Al Green who think about this. This is something that, you know, conservatives have brought up many times as well. Libertarians bring it up often. There is a process for how you're supposed to engage in war. There are some carve-outs for the executive branch to operate in certain situations. I'm not sure this is one of them, frankly, but it's not like this is out of normal, out of the norm behavior for our presidents. This has been happening for a long time through many presidents. So you're not looking, you're not talking about an issue that's really has its foundations here. You're going back quite a ways. I think we should probably go back to the way it was, frankly. I think, you know, having Congress be the ones that declare war is probably the right thing to do. There might be some carve out for something, a very small type of operation, certainly in immediate defense that is carved out, but it's not necessarily carved out for us to go over and, you know, even bomb nuclear facilities, though I generally support the idea of doing so as long as we don't get into massive involvement into the situation, as we've talked about before. By the way, with the impeachment going on, we've come to the point in the story where the most sensible person on the left seems to be Van Jones. I can't believe I'm even saying that, but here is Van Jones on CNN.
I think progressives underestimate how dangerous Iran is. Iran is not a normal country. Normal countries don't blind women because they showed some hair. They don't empower little gangs and proxies to surround a country and fire rockets and rape people. So Iran, the two things are clear. The what, they cannot have a bomb, and the why, because they say death to America, death to Israel, and death to all the Jews. One of those should offend you if you're progressives. At least one should offend you. And so the question, though, is the who and the how. Is Israel going to take out this nuclear capacity by dropping people there who blow it up? Or is America going to take it out by dropping a bomb that blows it up? But the what and the why are clear, and I think progressives should get on board with that. We cannot have a nuclear-armed Iran.
Amazing. And by the way, our condolences, I guess, to Scott Jennings, the conservative panelist there, who is in the hospital. He had to a bunch of pulled muscles in his neck because for the first time ever, he got to do this motion, this nodding motion, signaling a yes for the first time ever on CNN. So I'm sure he's very, very injured right now. And hopefully he's back with us very, very soon. The question, I guess, as to what actually happened last night is an interesting one. I went through the timeline a little bit. You had that situation where a ceasefire is announced. And then both Iran and Israel seem to indicate, either with silence or just straight out disagreement, that wasn't actually the case. They hadn't agreed to it yet. Iran straight out said they hadn't even received a proposal yet for an agreement. And it's hard to know really what happened. There's kind of a few different ways to work through this. One, Donald Trump was able to broker an agreement with the help of Qatar as well to get a ceasefire going. And then Iran flaked on that deal. Very possible, right? Like, we could all kind of imagine that that's very, very possible. And that was the reason why there was so much consternation afterward. Another possibility, about possibility B, we'll call it, is there was a same sort of arrangement. Trump saw that happen. And then Israel flaked on it. It's possible. I would say less likely, though. The reason why I would say it's less likely is because of the obvious import Israel puts on the relationship between themselves and Donald Trump and America overall. If you remember, to give you just a quick example of this, tariffs. Donald Trump comes out, he's like, I'm putting tariffs on everybody. You better come out here. You better fix this really fast. I'm mad. You know, that whole, you remember that whole situation. One country, I think that I can remember, might have been two, but one country basically came back and said, hey, we'll drop all of our tariffs to zero immediately. And that country was Israel. Now, Israel, it's not about tariffs to Israel. That's not what they're looking for. They're fighting for their existence here. This isn't about a 10% tariff rate. This is about their existence in their entirety. Do they have a country or not? And having America by their side is a real reason why they do continue to have a country. So they will do everything they can that they feel is consistent with their security to make Donald Trump happy, make America happy. That's what they want. And so I would be very surprised if they just completely flaked on a deal that was already there. There is a third possibility here that I have to admit did cross my mind, and we should acknowledge and talk about a little bit here, which is maybe they were kind of close to a deal. Maybe they were kind of close to a deal in principle, but things hadn't been signed yet. And Donald Trump felt the need to say, hey, I'm going to push this over the edge. I'm just going to say it's done. Hey, it's definitely a possibility. And especially seeing the reaction afterward, it seems to me to be a sincere and legitimate possibility. And it's interesting to think about that because the motivations are good there, right? Donald Trump has a job as president of the United States. His job is to come up with the best solutions for whatever problem presents itself that is within the structure of the government that the Constitution allows. And obviously dealing in foreign affairs, it is something that is important, right? He has to deal with this stuff all the time. He's constantly going back and forth with these world leaders and trying to sort these situations out. His actual job is to try to get those situations to resolve themselves in the best way possible for the United States of America. I mean, America first, right? Like yes, we care about Israel. Yes, you know, we care about the people of Iran, maybe not the leadership of Iran. I don't really care about them all that much, but the people of Iran we care about. And we want that the best possibility to come out for all of them as well. But our priority is America, right? So it's his job for the best thing to happen for America. What he has determined is the best thing for America is allowing and going along with Israel to do these things and involving ourselves at a very limited basis, but not overdoing it, not getting involved with ground troops, not even continually flying over the country and dropping bombs. And so that's kind of where he is, and that is his job. What kind of makes this a little bit different than other presidents and other scenarios is the way Donald Trump does that job, which is he is constantly trying to negotiate. Okay, and he negotiates. His way of negotiating is, generally speaking, I think it's more than this, but he uses the public often to negotiate. He has behind-the-scenes conversations as well, of course, but when they don't go perfectly his way, usually what he does is try to expose them and exert incredible pressure onto the people involved that he wants to move. He wants Israel to sign. He wants Iran to sign. And there's a legitimate possibility what he did was say, you know what, I'm just going ahead with this. I'm going to speak this into existence. There was an agreement. It's signed. Everybody's agreed. We're all good. And then let one of these countries continue to fire and break it because they're the ones that are going to look like the bad guys. And I think that's part of his strategy here. You know, in that it seems to have led to a ceasefire, I think that's good, right? Like it's a positive outcome. I really do think Iran is a threat, and I think they are, under this leadership, particularly egregiously bad. So I'm glad that they're losing their nuclear structure, not to mention all the stuff that Israel's done, which in some ways is more important when it comes to their military leadership and other assets. So that's really, really important, and I want that to happen, though, as I acknowledged yesterday, there is a big part of me, too, that make sure we're very, very careful here. Don't overdo it. Don't get overly involved when we don't have to. So that's there. But another part of this is like understanding that the president says a lot of things that are not targeted at you. A lot of times we're just basically overhearing a conversation about somebody else. If that makes any sense. It's like, you know, you're kind of like sitting in the bar and there's a couple of people over there talking and you're like, gosh, I think that woman is cheating on her husband with that guy. And you're like, it's not really about me, but I'm hearing it. And I don't know what to do with that information. That's kind of where we are as the American people in a lot of these situations. And it creates something that makes me feel a little bit uneasy, which is, you know, we really can't always just believe everything as if it's straight fact coming out of the mouth of Donald Trump in these moments. And I say that with hesitation because I don't mean it as an insult. We often say about politicians, they don't tell the truth. And of course, Donald Trump has had his issues with that in the past. But like what I'm talking about here is something different. This is not him, you know, saying something to benefit his campaign or saying something to win an argument. This is something I think he's doing to try to move this in the right direction. And I think maybe it worked, right? Like, I think there's a good chance that actually this did push these parties a little bit to go in the direction that he wanted. So in that way, it's positive. But it is a strange place for us to be. And I don't know, you know, it's kind of hard to tell at times whether Trump is talking to us and asking us to believe something he's saying that's actually true, or if he's just saying something publicly so that parties will move the way that he wants them to move. You know, the North Korea one is an example I go back to often for his first term on this front, which is, hey, we're going to bomb the hell out of Kim Jong-un. He's toast. And then 10 seconds later, he's my good buddy. And, you know, I love him. And he's a great guy. And he's actually very powerful and strong. And it's like he does that all the time because he feels that's the best thing to say at that moment. Is either one of them true? Is he really Kim Jong-un's good buddy? Probably not. Right. Was he really ever going to bomb the hell out of North Korea? Probably not. I mean, certainly there's things that they can do that would elicit that response. But generally speaking, probably wasn't going to wind up going over there and just bombing them. So it's hard to tell. And I think that is something that we kind of have to face. We say this often here on this program, which is we judge Donald Trump by what he does and not by what he says. Part of that formula is to at times you have to kind of step back and realize he's not really talking to you. He's not talking to you. Your reaction to a lot of these things isn't all that important. I remember this going back several years as leading into the offseason happens, and we're leading up to the NFL draft. And as you know, I'm a fan of America's team, the Philadelphia Eagles. And by the way, they're Super Bowl champions, won the Super Bowl, just to let you guys know. And as we were going into the draft, I remember that year, I was doing what I do often, which is, in my off time when I'm not blabbing about Iran, I am engaged with sports content because that's, I love sports. I've always loved sports. And so I was engaging with a lot of NFL draft content and, really looking into all these possibilities for the Eagles to draft. And I kept looking and I would learn these guys and I'd watch the YouTube highlights and I'd say, oh, I get excited for this guy and I get excited for this guy. And then the draft came and they picked a bunch of people. And shockingly, they didn't seem to care at all about which people I studied. They just picked on their own basis. They did what they thought was right for their team, right? They didn't seem to have any interest at all, in my opinion, on those particular players. And what I take from that is that I realize I'm not really going to influence the Eagles draft process, nor am I going to influence how Iran and Israel wind up sorting things out. I can pray about it. God can influence it. But I can't do much of anything, frankly. And one time, as I was sitting there yesterday watching hours and hours and hours and hours trying to suss out what the hell was going on and who was saying what for what reason, I still, now 24 hours later, still don't know. And I wound up wasting multiple hours trying to figure it out. And I don't think to really any ends. I mean, I'm being honest with you. I'll tell you when I think I know something and when I don't know what I know, don't know. And right now, I think I know what I don't know. But I don't know it. And I could sit here and speculate with you. And there's some, I guess, some utility to thinking these things through a little bit. But like, you can get too obsessed with it, right? You can get too obsessed with the back and forth. There's a good argument to sit back and like, I don't know, spend some time with your kids and do things that are unrelated to this. Get the general sense. Obviously, I'd prefer you do it here and other Blaze TV hosts and everything else. We do our best to try to summarize these things for you. But like, there are times where you have to know your own limitations. And I found this yesterday of like, you know what? I don't know. There's no way I can know this. Is that why? I'm not supposed to say that on the air probably, but it's true. You know, sometimes we just get to that point where, we're not masters of the universe here. We don't know every single thing. We could talk to people who are experts. And I mean, that's what I'm going to do today. I'm going to ask Josh Hammer some of the questions that I have. I think he was there in Israel when all this stuff was going on. I don't know if he's still there, if he's back in the U.S. We'll talk to him here in just a second, and we'll figure it all out together. Back in a second. If you're looking to drop a few pounds this summer and prefer a natural solution, Lean could be what you're looking for. Lean is formulated to support healthy blood sugar levels, manage appetite, and help control cravings. It contains ingredients designed to help your body burn fat by converting it into energy, offering a simple way to achieve weight loss results. One of these ingredients is like some cactus, some edible cactus from India. I don't know how to pronounce it. It's supposed to help you control appetite. But, you know, I don't know. Doctors selected ingredients like that to offer a sensible, healthy approach for weight loss. And if you're interested, get started with 20% off using the code STU20 at TakeLean.com. It's code STU20 at TakeLean.com. Go there now. Check it out. And I think it might be something you want to try. It's TakeLean.com. The code is STU20. These statements have not been evaluated by the FDA. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease, and it's not a substitute or alternative for care from a healthcare provider. It's TakeLean.com. The code is STU20. Get 20% off.
Dein altes Sofa zerfällt langsam. Und die Black-Friday-Angebote sind wirklich unschlagbar. Aber dein Gehalt kommt erst Anfang des Monats. Kein Problem. Mit der PayPal-Bezahlung nach 30 Tagen. So hast du jetzt mehr Spielraum beim Bezahlen und der Betrag wird nach 30 Tagen automatisch und kostenlos von deinem Konto oder deiner Karte abgebucht. Alle Infos auf paypal.de/30 Tage. PayPal es. Vorbehaltlich Kreditwürdigkeitsprüfung verfügbar mit deutschem PayPal-Konto für Einkäufe zwischen 1 und 2.000 Euro.
I'm joined once again by Josh Hammer, senior editor at large for Newsweek and host of the Josh Hammer Show, also author of Israel and Civilization, The Fate of the Jewish Nation and the Destiny of the West. Very well timed, which you can pick up wherever you get your books. Josh, thanks so much for coming back on the program. Appreciate it.
Stu, it's always a pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah. Am I mistaken? Were you in Israel when all of this started? What was that like?
Pretty stressful, pretty harrowing, to be honest with you. We were there for purely personal reasons. My wife was born there, raised here in Florida where we live, but we went for my wife's cousin's wedding and a surprise birthday party for another family member. Totally personal, anodyne, frivolous, you know, reasons of sorts there. And the sirens first went off on our fourth or fifth night there, and we had no idea what happened. The sirens first went off at 3 a.m. Israel time, 8 p.m. on the East Coast of the United States. And, you know, you kind of get up groggy, you know, what's going on here? You go on Twitter or learn that at this point, the IDF has taken preemptive action inside of Iran. And thus it began. So the next 3-4 nights or so, we essentially tried to ride out the storm. And I think it's important to understand, Stu, that when we say riding out the storm, what that means is that you're essentially just living on pins and needles, waiting for your phone siren to go off saying, be near a bomb shelter. And then when the actual sirens in the vicinity in the town where you are go off there, you have 90 seconds, maybe 2 minutes to get to a bomb shelter. And we were there with our 6-month-old daughter. So this is really no joke, no joke at all there. So this we did this. We essentially tried to ride it out for a few days. After 4 nights or so, there was a terrible story where a neighboring town in the Israeli center to where we were, an Iranian ballistic missile got through the air defense. Frankly, too many of them have gone through Israel's air defenses. And in this particular instance, there were 2 people tragically who died, even though they did everything correctly, even though that they were in the bomb shelter. Because these bomb shelters, to recall, were built primarily to respond to Hamas in Gaza, these lower level rockets, not these hypersonic ballistic missiles from Iran there. So that to me was a massive wake up call, like, oh my God, I have to get our family out of here there. Did a little research. I got into contact with this program that the state of Florida under Governor DeSantis had partnered with called Gray Bull Rescue, trying to evacuate Americans. And I got in touch with State Senator Jay Collins of Florida, who was there on the ground with us in Israel. So we essentially evacuated from Israel to Jordan, did a night in Amman, Jordan, flew to Cyprus, which became kind of a focal point for a lot of evacuating Israelis there. So then we did a night in Cyprus. And then we flew to Tampa, Florida, where I was pleasantly surprised to see Governor DeSantis actually waiting there to greet us because we were on the first rescue mission there. The governor actually asked me to join him at an impromptu press conference. So after a 13-hour flight from Cyprus, I tried to do my best and just wing it from there. And then we went home. Dude, the whole thing lasted about 3.5 days from start to finish getting home from there. It was quite an ordeal, to put it mildly there, but thank God we are safe.
Wow, that's amazing. I had heard about that effort that Florida was involved in. I did not know you were actually on one of the flights, the first flight. So that's incredible. I mean, it's got to be massively stressful, even for somebody like you, who I know has spent a lot of time thinking about this. You wrote a book which covers this, particularly chapters 7 and 8 go into a lot of detail about our relationship with Israel as far as geopolitics goes and how we should be thinking about this situation with Iran. So can you kind of speak to that a little bit? How should we be looking at this right now?
Well, look, from an American perspective, Stu, it seems to me that Donald Trump was essentially convinced to get off the sidelines due to the early success of the IDF operations inside of Iran. So that initial statement from Secretary of State Rubio, lest we forget, was pretty clear that this is Israel's fight, not ours. But within days, the narrative started to shift a little bit. It seems to me, just reading the tea leaves based on the reporting that I've seen, that Donald Trump was somewhat torn as to whether or not to get in at the beginning there, but he was so impressed by what the IDF was accomplishing. And let's be clear, the IDF right out of the gate was pretty fantastic there, taking out half of the IRGC commanders, taking out the nuclear scientists there. You know, Mossad has eyes and ears throughout that entire country. It's really quite crazy. So from a U.S. perspective, Donald Trump decides to get in. We have this astonishing demonstration of unmitigated U.S. military prowess, blowing up Fordo, Natanz, Isfahan with all the Tomahawks, the B-2s, the massive bunker buster bombs there. And then he got out, and there was not a single American casualty. So from Donald Trump's perspective, especially with this very fragile ceasefire, it seems to me to be an absolute masterclass demonstration of how to be the commander-in-chief, of how to be a diplomat, a statesman there. Essentially accomplishing a decades-long, long-sought-for American foreign policy objective, which is neutralizing or heavily setting back the illicit Iranian nuclear program without a single American casualty. And then, you know, adding a ceasefire, however tenuous that ceasefire may be, it's an incredible cherry on top. And Israel, from their perspective, I think that their operational goals have been met here as well, because their goal, above all, was to set back the Iranian nuclear program. And through this tag team of sorts between the IDF and the U.S. military there, it seems like that has happened. The only question now, Stu, of course, is what happens with this very fragile ceasefire.
Yeah, you know, and there were, and you don't know what's going to happen there. You don't know what the long-term, storyline is going to be of this when history is written. But there was a lot of worry by some, even some on the right, who were very concerned that any involvement by us at all could really blow up in our faces in a major way. What do you say to people who were very much worried about that? I mean, is it, I want to kind of separate this out. I think there are some people who are just, some people who just, you know, are anti-Semitic and don't like Jews. That's, I'll put those on the side for a second, who just seem to disagree with everything that Israel does. But there are some, I think, you know, conservative disagreement. They were saying like, gosh, we've been in this situation a bunch of times. A lot of times when we get involved in the Middle East, it doesn't turn out that well.
No doubt about that. Anyone who has lived through Iraq and Afghanistan ought to be deeply sobered from American moralistic nation-building boondoggles. But the key thing, Stu, was that this was never going to be that. There was not a single person. I mean, unless I'm mistaken, I don't even think like Lindsey Graham was talking about sending in the 101st Airborne to topple the Ayatollah. Right. And, oh, the Americans are coming to build, you know, a Madisonian, Lockean, Jeffersonian democracy. I mean, no one was talking about this. It was simply not something that was on the table there. The only debate was whether or not there was going to be a precision strike operation, the likes of which Operation Midnight Hammer this past weekend actually was there. And anyone who knows Donald Trump's foreign policy should have seen that coming from day one. Donald Trump, you know, much to the chagrin of those who would try to impute their own hardline isolationist beliefs to Donald Trump, he's not an isolationist. His first-term foreign policy speaks for itself. He actually was very tough on Russia. He was deeply tough on China. He took out Qasem Soleimani. He took out Baghdadi, the head of ISIS there. He's not afraid to use military force when it serves a narrow conception of the American national interest. And I would argue that neutralizing a nuclear program for a fanatical regime that has been trying to maim and kill Americans since the regime took over, the hostage crisis that ended the Jimmy Carter presidency, the Beirut barracks bombings from the Iranian proxy Hezbollah in 1983, neutralizing such a regime's nuclear program absolutely serves the American national interest there. And then he tried to get out there, not a single casualty, get a ceasefire. This is classic Trump. It is just classic vintage Trump. So the people who are catastrophically predicting World War III or thousands of Americans slain there, who were fear-mongering that Russia and China are going to get in there. By the way, neither country essentially lifted a single finger to save their nominal ally Iran there. They just misread the room at best. That's probably the most charitable way that I can possibly put it there. I mean, maybe we can impute more nefarious motives, but if I'm being charitable, they simply just misread the situation there, because there are a lot of paper tigers here. Russia is a paper tiger. China is far too preoccupied with the Indo-Pacific there. No one was going to swoop in to rescue Iran. And that's obviously very clear what happened there. So tremendous credit to the commander-in-chief, Donald Trump, for making the correct decision there. And again, we'll see what happens. But even regardless, frankly, as to exactly what the ceasefire looks like or does not look like, Stu, At this point in June 2025, I think I can safely and confidently say that the Middle East is in the best position it's been in my entire adult lifetime, namely because Iran and its various proxies, Hamas, Hezbollah, Houthis, are very much all on the descent. And the other axis, that is Israel and the non-Islamist Arab states, Saudis, Emiratis, so forth, they're very, very much on the ascent. So the Middle East is actually in quite good shape at the moment.
Yeah, and we, you know, certainly were involved in this last piece, but a lot of this was almost exclusively Israel, and they deserve a lot of credit for that. When you look at this, Josh, and you step back and you say, okay, well, you know, the United States could get involved, and you make a good pragmatic case for us to be involved in this particular instance with Iran. But like, you make a case in the book that it goes beyond that, right? This isn't just like a bombing that we might engage in to support Kuwait or Madagascar. There's a specific reason why Israel is important to us and connects to our history and our culture. Can you go into that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. So look, there are multiple chapters in the books to kind of laying out the foundations of what I refer to as Western civilization. And Western civilization, as I formulated, essentially begins with the Bible and with God's revelation itself to Moses and the Israelites standing there at the base of Mount Sinai. When we speak about Western civilization, we're really speaking about the Bible and, above all, the two biblical religions, which are the original people of the book, the Jews, and then the great Gentile offshoot, the Christians, who have really built Western civilization there. And the argument that I present in the books to over and over and over again is that there are a lot of kind of nefarious actors out there. I think you and I both see them in certain pockets of social media, above all, but it's kind of spilling into real life as well. I think that there are a lot of people out there who, for XYZ reasons, have an agenda, not just trying to separate the United States from the state of Israel, but actually trying to separate the original people of the book, the Jewish people, from that great Gentile offshoot, the Christians who have built Western civilization. And my book is essentially a clarion call saying this simply cannot happen, because we have built Western civilization, Jews and Christians alike there. Christians building off of what is unmistakably an Old Testament foundation there. We have so much more in common than we have apart there. The American founders, by the way, understood this so incredibly well. I mean, Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin wanted the Great Seal of the United States to be Moses parting the Red Sea with the Israelites there. The founders, much like the pilgrims who sailed on the Mayflower, they actually thought of themselves as new Israelites, kind of crossing their proverbial version of the Red Sea itself. Abraham Lincoln, my single favorite statesman in American history, famously refers to Americans as an almost chosen people in this great speech he gave in New Jersey on the precipice of the Civil War. And on and on and on we go there. There's so many examples there, but this is very steeped in American history. It's very steeped in who we are. One final example, I mean, the Liberty Bell in Philadelphia there. You know, the Liberty Bell is not inscribed with a verse from Aristotle or Cicero. It's inscribed with a verse from the book of Leviticus there. You know, the Leviticus chapter 25, thou shalt proclaim liberty throughout the land and to all the inhabitants thereof. So this notion of biblical ecumenicism, of this Jewish-Christian alliance, is bread and butter to what the United States is. I think it's bread and butter as well to what Western civilization is. And if we want to roll back the very real hegemonic forces that threaten to engulf us, in the book, I identify at least three: Islamism, wokeism, and global neoliberalism. I think it is imperative that Jews and Christians lock arms and stand shoulder to shoulder like never before.
Yeah, it's a great book, and in one, especially in this time, that's really important. Before I let you go, Josh, I know you're a close observer of the court, of course. There's a bunch of Supreme Court stuff happening this week, but I don't want to get into that. Can you give me, like, it's the three-year anniversary of the Dobbs decision. Can you give me, 60 to 90 seconds on the legacy of this, what it has done, what it's accomplished, and what's still left to do?
Well, the Dobbs decision, Stu, very simply has overturned one of the gravest moral and legal wrongs in the entire history of the United States Supreme Court. I mean, it is right up there with the Dred Scott case of 1857, in my opinion, as the two most egregiously incorrect cases in the history of the Supreme Court. Now, what the Dobbs case did not do is ultimately do what many of us pro-life abolitionists want to do, which is actually abolish abortion in America. Now, it is true that the number of abortions has definitely gone down since the Dobbs decision, and praise be to God for that there. But there is a lot of work left to do in the various states, the so-called laboratories of democracy. There was a lot of work left to do as well at the level of the United States government and the Congress and the executive branch and so forth there. The Trump administration has done some of that already thus far in this second term. But we have a very long way to go towards actually accomplishing that which the original generation of abolitionists in the 19th century did, which was eradicate chattel slavery. It's going to take a long time. Pro-lifers are going to have to be very patient here. It took us 49 years, way too long to over overturn Roe versus Wade there. But thank God that Dobbs came out the way it did there. And we are right now, I think, on a very slow incremental basis, ultimately setting ourselves up for the ultimate eradication of abortion in America one day, God willing. Hopefully it'll be in our lifetimes.
I hope so as well. Josh Hammer, senior editor at large for Newsweek, host of The Josh Hammer Show, and also author of Israel and Civilization, The Fate of the Jewish Nation and Destiny of the West. Be sure to grab a copy today. It's a great time for it. Josh, thanks so much for coming on the program.
You bet, Stu. Thank you.
Well, it's June 24th, 2025, 3 years to the day since the Dobbs decision came out. A National Review has an editor's piece here, Dobbs Transformed America. A couple of interesting points in there that I think are worth bringing up and noticing. The great danger of the moment after Dobbs, of course, was the political backlash. It could have been something where Democrats were going to use this to their advantage and get these massive victories. It didn't happen. In the first elections held after Dobbs, Republicans regained control of the House. Every pro-life incumbent won in the Senate and governor's races. Interesting. With the latter group, including people who had signed into law major protections for unborn children. In red and even some purple states, politicians can enact some such protections and survive. What should the goal be? They write, in every state, pro-lifers should be pushing for the most life-protective regime of law that can be politically sustained. And that must include dispelling the dangerous legal and medical misinformation that supporters of abortion have been promoting. No pro-life laws anywhere in our country require doctors to wait for pregnant women undergoing medical crises to face imminent death before they can provide treatment. That is a really, really important one. And it's been kind of the way the Democrats have tried to promote how terrible this is. None of that is true. I can't tell you how many people believe it, though. Millions. So, you know, if you don't want to go to stewdoesmerch.com, get a 62422 piece of merch. You can do that, too. But, you know, if you happen to be talking to someone who brings that up, take the moment to correct them on it. Because honestly, that's costing women their lives. So I want to make sure that stuff gets squashed. You can get medical treatment everywhere, no matter what the abortion laws are there. We also have this from Washington Post. 3 years after Roe's overturn, Democrats less focused on abortion. And that goes back to what I was just talking about. It didn't work. The focus on abortion and making that the biggest issue in the world was something they very much did try. They thought that would be a direction that would work. Now, they paired that with things like democracy and situations like that, that they thought that combination could bring them all the way to the White House. But again, they have none of it now. They don't have the House. They don't have the Senate. They don't have the White House. They got none of it. And that's important to realize. I think a lot of people are shying away on the right from talking about these issues. We shouldn't shy away from them. Still, the Republican position or the conservative position or the pro-life position, when articulated, is still the more popular position. It has moved a little bit in some of these, in some of the polls toward the left-wing position. But generally speaking, people don't like third-term abortions. They don't like second-term abortions. They don't like kids being able to go get abortions without telling their parents. These sort of basic things, there's a lot of, they don't like partial birth abortions. There's a lot there that Republicans and conservatives can talk about. And I think the National Review, the way they wrote that up, is probably the right way to think about this. The most pro-life thing that you can do that is politically sustainable. That does not mean, however, we don't push for more. And that is an interesting thing that we've done in the past as conservatives is, we'll just go for what we can get right now and then stop, full stop. Hey, we've now achieved that goal. We have to have the same mindset as, you think of the left talking about gay marriage, for example. That doesn't mean you jump to some crazy other thing that, I don't even know what that thing would be, honestly. I have no goal beyond stopping abortion when it comes to pro-life issues. I don't want to also stop contraception. That's not interesting to me. I know it is to some, not to me. I just think that it's one of those situations where we should look toward making sure we go for that. I think there should be a constitutional amendment introduced every single time by conservatives that you eliminate abortion nationwide. It's not going to pass right now, but it's something that we should be on the record supporting and saying that, hey, this is a goal of ours and we're going to keep introducing it until we get to a place where it makes sense for everyone to come along for that ride. Because keeping people alive, generally speaking, a good thing. By the way, studiosmerch.com is where you can get those shirts, 624-22. People will ask you, what would happen then? What was that about? And you can tell them, and that's good. Being able to talk about life is not a bad thing. All right, back in a second. When you have to move, it's more than just packing boxes. It's a major life event. Whether you're relocating down the street or across the country, you deserve a real estate agent who takes your move seriously. Our own Glenn Beck learned this firsthand after dealing with countless agents who simply were just not up for the task. This is why he created realestateagentsitrust.com. It's a free service that connects you with reliable, dedicated professionals. Every agent is thoroughly vetted, highly experienced, and genuinely committed to making your buying or selling experience as smooth and successful as possible. It's not just about finding a new house, it's about securing your peace of mind. And these are the agents that Glenn would personally trust with his own move, professionals who understand how important this moment is for you. Choose confidence and clarity for your next move. Visit realestateagentsitrust.com, find that right person for you. It's a free service, by the way, for you, so why not take advantage of it? It's realestateagentsitrust.com. The name says it all, realestateagentsitrust.com.
Jeder meckert über den ÖPNV. Aber was steckt wirklich dahinter? Mit dem Podcast Ticket to Anywhere blickst du hinter die Kulissen des Nahverkehrs. Schauspieler Maximilian Mund reist zu seiner Oma, trifft spannende Menschen wie Malte Zierden oder Linda Zervakis und erklärt alles zu Bus und Bahn und wie sie besser werden können. Erlebe ein außergewöhnliches Audioerlebnis rund um unsere alltägliche Mobilität. Jetzt reinhören auf Spotify oder unter zukunftnahverkehr.de/podcast.
Look, Andrew Cuomo is awful. .com. You know that much, obviously. But he is running for mayor. A lot of people are like, gosh, he'd be better than this other guy. Honestly, I don't know how much tonight honestly really matters because it's a very good chance whoever loses tonight, Mamdani or Cuomo, is going to wind up running anyway in the general election. So it could be like four different candidates going at each other in the general election. It's going to be crazy. The latest development is, I'll just give you the headline. Andrew Cuomo was blackmailed as governor. Some sexual allegations were 100% fake. An undercover video from James O'Keefe. This is, he's talking to a senior New York Health Department lawyer. Now, of course, I mean, I think that's true with a lot of these public sexual harassment issues that kind of blow up into something like, you know, whatever it is. If there's five really credible reports of sexual harassment, there's likely to be a couple people who just kind of glom onto it, honestly, and say, oh, that me too. I was the Me Too thing is in a different way, I suppose, there. Yeah, that happened to me too. And then they wind up getting payouts or whatever, or at least attention as well. That's not always the case. Obviously, a lot of people have been abused by people like Andrew Cuomo. I would not be at all surprised if all of them were true, but I would also not be surprised if some of them were not true. We will see how that goes. But so the election tonight. So basically what you're going to have to give you kind of set the stage, you have a relatively close election between Mamdani and Cuomo. You know, I'd still put Cuomo as the favorite. There's really only one poll that points to the fact that Mamdani might win this thing. But what you want to see tonight, and you'll probably only get the first round of election results tonight, is what does that gap look like? If the gap is in single digits, you have a chance for Mamdani to win in the ranked choice voting rollout. That won't happen until July 1st, because they have to wait for every ballot to come in before they can start doing ranked choice voting. So they got to wait until July 1st when they have all the ballots. Then they will start tabulating. If it's 12, 13 points tonight, likely Mamdani is not going to be able to make up that sort of gap. If it's four, he's got a good chance of doing it. We will see how that plays out tonight and into early July. And then even if no matter who loses, there's a good chance that loser winds up running as an independent or a small party member. Cuomo, I think, has one of them locked up. He can go on and run in the general. So a lot to look at and really not too many answers tonight, but it will start to get interesting when ballots are counted this evening. Okay, so here's what happened. We have a website that is associated with this particular network. It's called theblaze.com. You can go there for all the important stories of the day. You can also go there for stories apparently like this one. And I'm not going to give you too much detail. I want you to go read the story because it is a fascinating one. But here's the headline. Cheap hot dog sparks deadly dispute at nudist resort that ends in grisly deaths of elderly couple and dog. Colon police. So I don't think the police were killed. That's a good thing. But other than that, it was not a good situation. So there you go. Go read it at theblaze.com. Never anyone under 65 at a nudist resort, I'm noticing. Just never the case. All right, 62422 is the merch. It's the anniversary as well. Go check it out. StuDoesMerch.com, code Stu10.